Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook paper and pen so you can take some notes during the show. First, we look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. From an article in the Philadelphia Inquirer by Jamie Lau called A Compounding Nightmare, low and middle class households with credit card debt owe, on average, $9,827 on their card. If you make the minimum monthly payment, often 2% of the balance, or $10, at 10% interest, it will take you more than 26 years to pay off the balance, including $6,812 in interest. But what if the interest rate was raised, or if your rate was tacked to the prime rate, currently 3.25%? It could take more than a lifetime to pay off that debt. In May, Congress adopted the Credit Card Accountability, Responsibility, and Disclosure Act to protect consumers from capricious rate hikes. Under the Act, banks must give consumers at least 45 days' notice before raising their rates. And beginning in February, banks cannot raise rates on existing balances unless a consumer is in default. Just recently, however, House Financial Services Committee Chairman Barney Frank accused banks of abusing the grace period they were given before all the law's provisions take effect. For example, Wells Fargo announced it was raising rates on existing accounts by up to 3 percentage points. Other card issuers, including Bank of America and J.P. Morgan Chase, have also been accused of raising rates on balances prior to the law's effective date. Additionally, in June, Bank of America and Chase switched many cardholders from fixed to variable rate cards. Variable rate cardholders are not protected from unexpected rate changes under the new law because rate changes are permitted as the prime rate moves up and down. Those most likely to be harmed by higher borrowing costs are consumers who are relying on their credit cards to carry them through the economic downturn. According to Demos, a nonpartisan research and advocacy organization, most low and middle income households with high debt stress levels, the ratio of a family's credit card debt to its annual income, use their credit cards to pay for medical expenses or to cover household essentials after a job loss, not for discretionary items. Higher rates lead to longer payoff periods and thousands of extra dollars in interest payments. Let's take the case of the average low and middle income households with $9,827 in credit card debt. If they continue to make the minimum monthly payment on that amount, but at 13% interest plus prime, rather than our previous example of 10% interest, they must pay $19,887 in interest payments over the more than 45 years it will take to clear the balance. Not the $6,812 in interest in 26 years to pay off the balance. And this example likely presents a best-case scenario. Many cardholders have responded to the downturn and the higher borrowing costs by reducing their debt. In July, revolving credit, which is largely credit card borrowing, declined. For many, however, reducing debt simply is not an option. Moreover, changes in the availability of credit are also making it more difficult for cardholders to protect themselves from the bank's actions. In the past, cardholders could demand better terms by threatening to take their business elsewhere. Today, this option is limited because many banks have tightened credit card approval standards. Banks may be putting themselves at risk by their actions as well. If consumers are subjected to usurious rates as the prime rate rises, more will inevitably default on their debt. Banks will find it difficult to make up for these losses by further raising rates on consumers who are already stretched to their limits. Bank of America vowed recently to stop raising interest rates before the February limits take effect, making the announcement as Frank's committee met to consider moving up the effective date of the new legislation. But such a promise offers too little, too late, for many consumers who have already been harmed. It is time for banks to rethink their recent moves and for Congress to do more to protect consumers. And from Emery D'Alessio, an AP writer, states raise limits on creditors as debtors squirm. With many Americans in dire financial straits, states are cracking down to make sure aggressive debt collectors target only people who legitimately owe them money. National consumer credit laws already prohibit collection agencies from harassing, deceptive, or unfair practices like telling neighbors or family about what is owed or calling before 8 a.m. or late at night. Since the recession started, at least a half dozen states have adopted additional limits, like imposing statutes of limitation on collections and adding opportunities to punish abusive practices in court. Other states may follow suit. Lawmakers are increasingly focusing on outfits that buy bad debt from credit card companies and other lenders for pennies on the dollar and profit when they collect more than they paid. Debtors, some agree they owe money, others say they've already paid or are disputing their bills, have reported being bombarded with calls and subjected to foul language and threats of arrest or even deportation. A North Carolina law that took effect this month requires debt buyers filing collection lawsuits to produce documents proving they're the ones owed the money. Trying to collect on a debt that a company should reasonably know is invalid could lead to lawsuits and civil penalties of up to $4,000 per violation. North Carolina Attorney General Roy Cooper cites the case of a 65-year-old woman who has been plagued by up to 5 collection calls a day until her lawyer demanded proof she owed the money, then learned collectors were looking for a debtor in Greensboro, about 140 miles to the west. "We've gotten a lot of cases that the debt is not owed or the debt has been paid off," Cooper said. "They call and they browbeat people to pay money that they don't even owe." Other states, including Idaho, Colorado, New York, Arkansas, and Maryland, along with New York City, have also recently passed more explicit rules for debt collectors. Legislators in several more, including Massachusetts and New Jersey, have pushed bills that could come up again in next year's legislative sessions. North Carolina's law came too late to help Eleanor Chittum, 63, who now lives in Winston-Salem Convalescent Home. Her record showed she owed $1,439 to Direct Merchants Credit Card Bank on a Visa card, but paid off that account by transferring it to another card. She was stunned when a collection company contacted her to say she owed $1,800. "Then they sent me a bill for that amount, and I said, 'Why do I owe that? I paid it off,'" Chittum said. "I was shocked to see this bill come in." A North Carolina company called Brock and Scott Holdings, Inc. filed a lawsuit in late 2007 saying Chittum owed them the original amount plus interest. The company's lawyer said it wasn't required to prove from the outset that Chittum owed the debt, just that its records were kept properly. Under the new state law, it would have had to document that she owed the money. If she owes the debt, she'll pay it. We've tried for a year and a half to get them to prove that she owes the debt, said Charles Hall, a legal aid attorney representing Chittum. Neither Brock and Scott Holding executives nor an attorney pursuing Chittum's debt responded to requests for a comment. The bottom line, people should pay their debts, Cooper said. But with this legislation, the debt buyer must produce proof that the debt is actually owed. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And I'd like to continue with the second segment of the show. Recently, I've been going over a concept called the two-income trap. And I'd like to start with an important credit, because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in these programs are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi, two of America's leading champions for debtors. I highly recommend their books, All Your Worth, and a book called The Two-Income Trap, which I am using as the textbook for these shows. You can also go into the archives at www.kruufm.com and look under Life and Debt to listen to all of the shows which have been produced on debt-related issues and can help you educate yourself tremendously on debt problems. So what I've been looking at is the average two-income family, and the average two-income family has earned far more today than did the single breadwinner family of a generation ago. And yet, once they have paid the mortgage, the car payments, the taxes, the health insurance, and the daycare bills, today's dual income families have less discretionary income and less money to put away for a rainy day than the single income family of a couple of generations ago. And so the two income trap has been neatly sprung for the two-income families. Mothers now work two jobs at home and at the office, and yet they have less cash on hand. Mom's paycheck has been pumped directly into the basic cost of keeping the children in the middle class. At the same time millions of mothers went to work, the family needed the stay-at-home mom or a costly replacement more than ever. The number of elderly, most of whom must depend on family for daily care, has spiraled upwards. And hospitals also have been discharging patients quicker and sicker than ever, expecting the family to pick up the task of nursing the elderly back to health. With mom in the workforce, parents were faced with a painful choice between paying for expensive care and taking time off work. The situation was compounded by leaner and meaner business climate that has closed plants and laid off workers with alarming frequency. So in this tougher world, millions of two-income families learned the price of living without a safety net. When we analyze this, inevitably, the two-income trap affected the one-income family, too. When millions of mothers entered the workforce, they ratcheted up the price of a middle-class life for everyone, including families that wanted to keep mom at home. A generation ago, a single breadwinner who worked diligently and spent carefully could assure his family a comfortable position in the middle class. But the frenzied bidding wars, fueled by families with now two incomes, changed the game for single-income families as well, pushing them down the economic ladder. To keep mom at home, the average single-family income must forfeit decent public schools and preschools, health insurance, and college degrees, leaving themselves and their children with a tenuous hold on their middle-class dreams. Then what about single-parent families, the group that has no choice about getting by on one income? Not surprisingly, these are in even worse shape than their married counterparts. But the magnitude of the problem for single mother families is shocking. If current trends persist, more than one of every six single mothers will go bankrupt by the end of this decade, which is a year away. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that they have or will file bankruptcy. It just means that financially their debt exceeds their income and assets that could be liquidated. So, by definition, they are bankrupt or insolvent. Historically, the explanations for why these women are in trouble, deadbeat dads who don't pay child support, discrimination in the workplace, and so forth, cannot account for the tremendously growing distress. Today's middle-class single mothers have better legal protection, higher salaries, more child support, and more opportunities in the workplace than their divorced counterparts of a generation ago, yet they face a much greater likelihood of financial collapse. As of 2004, the estimate is that over the past 20 years, the number of single mothers in bankruptcy has increased more than 600%. Those are actual filers. So why are these women in so much trouble? Well, the answer lies in the changes in the family balance sheet before a couple divorces explains much about the vulnerability of today's single mothers. Married parents are in trouble because they have spent every last penny and then some just to buy a middle-class life for their children. As a result, today's newly divorced mother is already teetering over a financial abyss the day she signs her divorce papers. She has nothing in the bank, and the family's fixed costs stretched the limits of two incomes, let alone one. She really hasn't a prayer of competing with double-income families to provide her children with what have come to be seen as the basic requirements of a middle-class upbringing. Well, is the only solution for all the mothers to hurry back to the hearth? This may sound like a tidy resolution, but frankly, it won't work anymore. Like it or not, women now need those paychecks to pay the mortgage and the health insurance bills. The whole economic structure has changed. Their incomes are committed, and calling for them to abandon those financial commitments would mean forcing them to give up their family spot in the middle class. According to Professor Warren, the real solution lies elsewhere in addressing the reasons behind the bidding war and helping all families, both dual and single income, to get some relief. The two-income trap is really ironic because middle-class mothers went into the workforce in a real calculated effort to give their families an economic edge. Instead, millions of them are now in the workplace just so their families can break even. At a time when women are getting college diplomas and entering the workforce in record numbers, their families are in more financial trouble than ever. Partly, this is just a matter of bad timing. Despite general economic prosperity, up until very recently, the risks facing their families jumped considerably. Partly, we were all victims of optimistic myopia. The women and families saw the rewards a working mother could bring without seeing the risks associated with the newfound income. And partly, they were the victims of one another. As millions of mothers poured into the workplace, it became increasingly difficult to put together a middle-class life on a single income. The combination has taken women out of the home and away from their children, and has simultaneously made family life less, not more, financially secure. Today's middle-class mother is trapped. She can't afford to work, and she can't afford to quit. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Continuing on the understanding of the two-income trap, When we look at it, both mothers and fathers are trapped in the same sinking boat, but it is mothers who have been the special targets of change over the past generation. It is mothers who left the home en masse, transforming generations of family economics. It is mothers who must do it all, tending to home and children, while managing full-time jobs outside the home. And it is nearly always mothers who preserve the remnants of the family in the aftermath of the divorce. Of course, there are exceptions to these statistics, but this is just the data we must face. Even for a married couple, financial failure is disproportionately a woman's problem. A husband and wife who have been struck by financial disaster look more or less the same on paper. They share the same assets, they owe the same debts, and they have the same black marks on their credit reports. But behind the curtain of marriage, there are important differences. According to Professor Warren, in this age of nominal equality between husbands and wives, in the most intimate aspect of their lives, family finance, couples reveal a surprising traditionalism. Research shows that on average, a husband is 3 times more likely than a wife to take primary responsibility for managing the family's money. But as a couple sinks into financial turmoil, this responsibility tends to shift. As families fall behind on their bills, it is wives who roll up their sleeves and do what must be done. Wives who deal with foreclosure notices, wives who plead with creditors for more time to pay, and wives who insist on seeking credit counseling or help. And speaking as a bankruptcy
attorney,
it is often, if not almost always the case, the wives who contact the bankruptcy attorney. And often it is the wives who ultimately decide when it is time to file that bankruptcy. Among couples who seek credit counseling or file for bankruptcy, the split over who was responsible for dealing with the bills was exactly reversed from that of secure families. 3/4 of the wives were exclusively responsible for trying to extract their families from their financial quagmire, according to the data. This shift is not merely a realignment of responsibilities within the household, a simple variation of the routine decisions that he will mow the lawn while she folds the laundry. Rather, what it is a signal of serious discord within a marriage. In financially troubled families, women who managed the money alone were twice as likely to describe themselves as very dissatisfied with the arrangement than the men who took on the task. Many women, exhausted and frustrated by all that accompanies the descent into financial ruin, find that just when they need the most help, their husbands have disappeared. Men, for their part, often feel that their failure to provide for their families calls into question not just their abilities in the labor force, but also their identities as husbands, as fathers, and as men. Perhaps it should come as no surprise to discover that financial problems and marital problems are statistically linked. Study after study shows that money is a source of contention in most marriages, but it is particularly problematic for couples that are financially unstable. For a family living on the edge financially, every purchase must be scrutinized, creating flashpoints for conflict in marriages that are already overly stressed. With no one close at hand to blame for layoffs at work or exclusions in the health insurance policy, it is really too easy to turn frustration and anger on one another. Couples slip into an endless round of should-haves, second-guessing themselves and each other for decisions long past. There are all kinds of thoughts that come up. He should have worked the night shift when he had the chance, or she should have kept driving the old car, or he should have bargained for a better price on the home, Or perhaps she should have spent less on groceries. For some, and quite unfortunately, words give way to physical blows in an escalating battle to assess blame. As one bankruptcy trustee said to Professor Warren, helping families use the bankruptcy courts to get protection from their creditors, he stated, "I'm in the abuse prevention business. Every time I help a family get straightened out financially, I figure I save someone a beating." We can make no mistake about it. Financial distress is a problem for both men and women. The problem is about both men and women, about mothers and fathers. But Professor Warren is very clear that the phenomena are not entirely gender neutral. Mothers are 35% more likely than childless homeowners to lose their homes, 3 times more likely than men without children to go bankrupt, and 7 times more likely to head up the family after a divorce. And so, the two-income trap is a story about families, about children, but really it is especially about mothers. So in the shows that will follow, I'll be telling the story of how having children has become the dividing line between the solvent and the insolvent, and how today's parents are working harder than ever and falling desperately behind, even with two incomes. What we will see is a story of how the state of affairs is not some unavoidable feature of modern economy, or for that matter, the inevitable byproduct of women's entry into the workforce. The whole point in this analysis is so that we as individual mothers and fathers, along with politicians and scholars, child advocates and labor organizers, pro-family conservatives and liberal feminists, will take a serious look at the economic forces that have battered the American family. The concept here is to look at the hard numbers and to take it seriously. And then, of course, also to see that there are ways out. There are changes that can happen, real changes, practical changes, and meaningful changes. A lot of these changes have to be made in Congress, in state legislatures, in school boards, and in families. Of course, for most of us, it's going to be at the local level in the families and in the school boards. But it really is about change. Changes that can make it so that the average parent can once again spend her nights fretting about potty training and prom dresses, not about home foreclosures and overdrawn bank accounts. Changes that hopefully can make America's great middle class secure once again. I will continue next week expanding this analysis and get into the issue of what is called overconsumption, and for many, what is called the overconsumption myth, which tells a tale to explain a confusing world, and is put out there as an explanation why so many Americans are in financial trouble, why credit card debts are up and savings down, and why millions of mothers are heading into the labor force and working overtime. It's a thought that is really deeply embedded in our collective understanding, and it resists questioning. Families have spent too much money buying things they don't need. Americans have a new character flaw, the urge to splurge, and it is driving them to spend and spend like never before. So we'll investigate more of that next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.